What is wrong with you? Welcome to We Are Libertarians this week. Presenting the sound effects for this podcast was Chris Gault.
You can't prove that.
This has been we were off last week because the beginning of the semester sort of threw us in a tailspin as the three of us tried to get our schedules readjusted. So we are actually recording on Thursday night. We said 6 o'clock. It's now 6:56.
Oh man,
and we're recording. Yeah, hope you two don't have anywhere to go.
Yeah, Creighton told his girlfriend he would be home at
7:30. You need to talk into the
You're
mic.
Not even going to be done.
So, huh?
I told you 6 o'clock while we were at the meeting today.
No,
I told you 6 o'clock.
Hey, talk into the mic, Creighton, because we have a friend of the podcast here, and we'll introduce him in a minute. So we've got a different mic strategy, so it may sound a little bit weird and different and awkward.
No more than usual.
Yeah, exactly. So, right. You know, I don't know if it's because we're doing a night show, and we've only ever done, I think, one other night show.
Where are you going with this, Spangle?
You two are really cranky. What? Like, you two walked into the studio today and you just started yelling at each other.
Galt's a douche.
Okay, talk closer to the mic.
Galt's a douche.
I like
swing
Creighton.
It towards you.
Don't say it again.
Galt is a douche.
We heard that one loud and clear. Why is Galt a douche?
I don't know. It's his personality,
that.
I guess.
Give me that pencil.
He was...
Like,
he does douchey things.
Now, that's not fair. Would you like to say something
about
him?
His douchebaggery has increased a lot.
I just tell people that Creighton acts like he doesn't like me, but he likes me.
You seem to, poor Galt, seems to get himself into a lot of trouble. You just sort of tell it like it is, and that sort of seems to get you into a lot of trouble, especially with your fellow libertarians,
well,
I've noticed.
But I get stuff done,
right.
So they keep me around.
That is true. Usually the people who offend the most people get the most stuff done. I work with one of those people.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
he doesn't necessarily tell it like it is. He tells it like he sees it.
See.
Right.
Which isn't always exactly like it is.
I wish you could see the smile on Creighton's face. If we had the capability of really doing video streaming, then you could.
Because we were talking about our podcast at our YAO meeting today.
Right.
And students asked, well, what do you guys talk about? And Creighton was like, well, most of the time we just make fun of Galt. And it's the truth, though. That's all you guys do.
That is not true.
This is a comedy podcast.
We make fun of me. You posted for my birthday was September 9th. I turned 29 years old. And what did you write on the Facebook? And I don't know which one of you it was, but I know it was you. What did you write?
You didn't know it was me.
Yeah,
how do you know it was me?
Because he wouldn't do that. It was a douchey thing to do, so I knew it was you.
All right. All I did was say you were a little too old for our podcast now because you're.
That's why I made the podcast
out of that millennial generation.
That's why I made it for people under 30.
Yep.
You don't grow.
You got
out
1 year left.
You don't grow out of the millennial generation. It follows you. It's not like you grew out of the baby boomer into the traditional generation. So there's just a little bit of tension today, and I think that's good for the listeners, but it's bad for like James Neese and I sitting here going, "Why are these two fighting like a couple of old women?" No offense to old women.
I don't fight.
You do. You do kind of.
He's very passive aggressive.
The problem.
He's very passive aggressive. So while I do the yelling,
but that doesn't mean
he tends to quietly say things that.
Isn't that weird that I'm the quiet one in the argument?
Galt goes, well, I don't know why you think I'm passive aggressive, but I don't think I am.
He does this thing where he gives you this deer in the headlight stare, like, why are you upset at me for being a douchebag?
What did I do? Hey.
What really started it is. Every Thursday, this place is like a bus station. There's a ton of people that come in here. It's awesome because, you know, the other 5 days that I'm in here, we're sitting here by ourselves, and it's basically just myself, Rupert's campaign manager, maybe one or two volunteers cycle through. But on Thursdays, we have a lot of people come in through the day. And so before, we were sitting around Evan McMahon, Jeremiah Hodgkin. They've both been on the podcast, James Neese, the three of us. Just sitting there, you know, making fun of each other. People were calling. We were making fun of them, too. And then I walk away, and then all of a sudden the seeds of hatred get planted between Palestinian Galt and Israeli Creighton.
You didn't hear me yelling. It's never
See,
me. Every single
aggressive.
Time.
Passive aggressive. That's exactly
I'm
what he's
sitting here smiling. I'm having a great time.
Maybe it's just me, but when people are being douchebags and they're not yelling at me, it makes me angrier.
Well,
It's like, at least have the cojones to yell at me when you're going to be a douchebag.
Just totally gave him exactly what he was talking about. It wasn't me that was yelling. You know?
It wasn't.
All right. Well, let's talk about the seeds of what has planted this discord among the podcast here. Let's talk about the big news coming up here in early October.
Yeah.
Mr. IUPUI Executive President something or other. Tell us about the big news that's coming to IUPUI on October 4th.
The regatta.
No. Gary Johnson is coming to IUPUI October 4th. Yep.
I'm the only one? Okay.
Well.
Golf claps don't work on the road.
October 4th at IUPUI in the Lecture Hall 101. It's going to start at 7 o'clock. Ending time is still to be determined.
Beginning time is still determined, right? Or is it 7 p.m. for sure?
Well, okay. Fair enough. It's a tentative 7, but I really think it'll be 7 o'clock.
Okay. We're still working out scheduling with the Johnson campaign and all kinds of stuff. So.
Yeah. We'll have different speakers there as well, including Rupert will be there.
Rupert Bonham.
Other speakers I'm not going to announce yet.
To be determined.
There will be a few more, at least one or two more.
Any possibility of music? I know that's part of the argument that we're having this evening. Which is why we'll bring in James Neese here in a minute. He's the one yelling at you about it.
Well, the struggle was the venue, and it just...
It's in the lecture hall?
Yeah.
Okay. So it's really tough to have music in the lecture hall. You're sitting in, like, Biology 101, and next door is... dubstep.
But it wasn't my first choice.
Right.
I tried... probably like 7 other places before I got this room.
Right. It is amazing how tough it is to find space in Indianapolis. Like, you think that a city with 1 million people and donut counties with another 1 million people, it'd be really easy to find space that's fairly reasonably priced or free, and it's nearly impossible.
Yeah,
it's ridiculous.
I couldn't believe it on a Thursday night.
Yep.
But that's where we're at right now. The room holds 500 people. So
hey, we recorded a podcast. I think we posted we were recording a podcast room at Rupert for Governor headquarters, and I think we posted a picture before. And we have some foam that covers the windows so people won't walk by and distract us. Well, the foam fell down, so now we've got open windows, and it's volunteer night at Rupert's headquarters now. So there's roughly 20 people in here volunteering for Rupert, and each and every one of them has just walked by in the last like 10 minutes to wave hi. Listen, don't fact check me, son. So let's introduce our guest here. It's basically like interviewing 4chan. This is our friend James Neese. James, how are you doing?
I'm pretty great.
All right, wonderful. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
You just kind of wrote me into it. You're like, we're going back in this room. And
you lift the mic up.
Start hooking things up to your face, and I'm like, yo, what's going on here, bro? We're gaming or...
And for those of
play some EverQuest.
For those listening, that is exactly how he talked.
Are you serious? Did you just say, what is EverQuest?
Oh, I don't...
like, millions?
You deal with the PvP
talk into
champ.
The mic, buddy.
You're dealing with the PvP champ, man. Like, when you play video games, like, do you play it because it's fun? No, you play it to grind your opponents into dust.
Yeah.
To be the greatest.
Digital
dust. No, real life dust.
Like fairy dust, because it's pretend.
When you're defeated in a video game like that, it's not like you're like, oh man, I'm sorry, I lost, man, I'm bad. No, you bad, you mad. So you're sitting there going to your house, smashing up your house.
If anybody wants to know a fun fact about me, I was actually ranked number 1 in America at a Star Wars game online.
Wow. Do you have a girlfriend?
Number 3. Number 3 in the world, number 1 in America.
Right.
So
you didn't answer my question.
So
tell us a little bit about yourself. The waves of the microphone around. This is just a disaster. We should start over, but we're not going to because let's soldier on. So tell us a little bit about yourself, James.
Well, what do you want to know? I mean,
I don't know.
Why are you here?
Why am I here?
Why are you even in this building?
It's getting existential.
Why I'm here? Because there's a reason, like, well, you're running for office. Yeah, I'm running for, like, District 100, right? So, like, when Galt's like, why are you in the building? It's like, I'm just bored and I need friends. So it's like, there's people here.
I mean, so, okay, the most honest answer I've ever heard. Right. I'm just bored and I need friends.
usually I come in, like, you know, like, at least like once or twice a week and just to do like flyers. some little door hanger flyers. So apparently not doing that right now because, like, it's highly distracting today. It's like, you know, why do work when I can talk on a microphone and just see where this rolls?
Literally since 5:30, nothing has got done in this office.
Yeah. Well, you want to tell us more about your campaign?
Yeah, sure. Well, one of the few things we do with my campaign is I run through Fountain Square in Irvington. So if you're a older person, you're probably like, oh, that's a nice community, nice shopping places. If you're a young person, you're like, yeah, man, free graffiti. It's an art community. Both these things are art communities. We have, like, Radio. We have different things in Irvington, like Lazy Days Coffee Shop as well. So my district is a very fun district for somebody that's running third party. I mean, it's I think it's predominantly liberal. But as I go through and I'm just, like, talking with different people, like, dudes with 3-foot-high mohawks and people with, like, more piercings than, you know, I guess a dart game. Like, you know those games you just throw darts at? Like, some people literally look like that after a while, like, right in their face. But as I talk to, like, different people, like, a lot of these people aren't too interested in politics. I mean, yeah, it's nothing that, like, you know.
Like, you think that they would be more open to a third party, especially a third party way of politics. So you've kind of found that people in the Irvington area are not as interested in politics?
I mean, they are. The difference between, like, their politics and, let's say, like, the average everyday person's politics, like, you know, like, when you view politics, everybody here views politics, we're on, like, Facebook sharing, like, ridiculous pictures of Obama photoshopped or Romney photoshopped, right? That's right, our daily politics. You know, maybe some, like, articles from CNN or something. To them, politics is alternative. It's, I attend rallies. I attend the Dynasty Young rally that was at the schoolyard where he got expelled from school for bringing a taser to defend himself. So they attend those. So it's more like I want to be proactive in making these changes instead of voting, which I think it's just a nice way of saying that I don't get up to, like, 6 o'clock at night. So I really missed the voting polls. I mean, they probably wanted to vote. You know, they have, like, their whole, like, list out, man, I'm definitely going to vote for this candidate this week. And then you wake up, it's like, well, damn, I missed it. What am I going to do? Let's go to Mr. Dan's and get some Coney dogs. So I feel like it's a good all thing right with the youth. I mean, like, I'm here with Galt, and, like, there's times I'll go to IUPUI. It's, like, 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Any normal person's up by now, and he doesn't have class. And I'm like, okay, I'll call. I'll go to this YAL meeting. And this dude's nowhere to be found. And I'm like, this dude is either A, passed out sleeping, or B, no, he's just somewhere in his car getting stoned off, like, 65.
What?
So I'm like,
no, you did not tell me you were coming to that YAL meeting. I had no idea, or I would have went. I asked Reno. I said, hey, do you want me to come? Because on Thursdays I don't have classes, so I don't even go to campus. I just came today because we were doing the podcast, and
right,
so I only go up there if it's important. Reno told me nobody,
you know,
important
really
was coming.
If you loved me, you would definitely come to places even though I don't tell you. You know what I mean? Well,
but if I knew you were there, I probably would have came.
James uses passive-aggressive activity right back on goal.
Nah,
and yet I'm still smart. I'm not yelling like Creighton, am I?
That was passive-aggressive again.
And I redirected the passive-aggressiveness.
So basically you're like, I don't have class on Thursday, so I don't do absolute shit on Thursday.
No, that just...
Oh, hey, whoa. This is a family-friendly podcast,
you know,
there,
today,
son.
Today, it's PG-13.
All right, well, watch your mouth, son.
Well, I did stuff today, and...
I know how you can get confused because I curse like a sailor.
Just because
off-air.
I don't go to school, just because I don't go to campus on Thursday doesn't mean I don't do anything.
What do you do?
Well, I send a lot of emails.
Okay. All right.
I do.
Sounds like...
I bet you last Thursday, when was it? Last Thursday? A week from today?
There's a
Thursday week ago
every
from
week,
today?
Yeah.
I was probably doing Johnson stuff.
Gross.
And I probably could have used your help. I probably could have went up to the school and used your help that day.
It's kind of gross, like he said.
That was so passive. Now I can't do anything but see it. What have you done to me, Creighton? I probably could have used your help if
so
I had
asked
you.
You're at home spamming F5 on your email, touching up on Johnson stuff, and you needed our help.
Yeah.
You don't see how that sentence.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let me get control of the show here. What has happened? Okay. Let's get back to politics. So thank you for coming on the podcast today. We're not sending you off. We want you to stick around and joke a little bit. Tell us, how can we find out more info on your campaign? Where can we get materials? And where is District 100?
Okay. You can get, like, a lot of my materials off, like, my websites. It's, like, facebook.com/IndieNiece or jamesniece@neasc.webs.com.
Mm-hmm.
I also have Twitter accounts that if you're on there, you can adjust that. I have like different widget panels as well, so I can connect on my websites, like my emails. But District 100 is, if you're going down Emerson or you're in a place where it's like, that's a lot of teenagers that look like they don't shower, you're probably in District 100.
That's why you're our man, James. And, you know, to be fair, let's talk about your politics a little bit, because you've taken some heat from people within the party because you are a little more left-leaning than most of our average candidates, aren't you? You're probably, you'd be described as a left-leaning libertarian, and in California, you'd probably fit right into the LP there. But here in Indiana, there's a lot of conservative people in the party, especially, and not conservative big C, but just people who live conservative lifestyles. And James has long hair. He has the Guy Fawkes mustache. You know, he lives in Irvington. He's a creature of his environment, and he's perfect for that district. So, I mean, talk about a little bit about what you believe, why you're a little bit more left of maybe, say, Andy Horning, a constitutional conservative. What makes you different between, like, an Andy Horning and you?
Okay. Well, there's a few videos. Like, if you go to YouTube, you type in, like, what is left libertarianism, you'll probably get some, like, old, like, Noam Chomsky videos that pop up where he's just talking about, like, historical aspects of what libertarianism is. A lot of people get confused, like, you know, like, we're a libertarian party, so do we apply to, like, a European aspect of libertarianism? And you have to go back to the history of this party. Like, this party was a few votes away from being the new Liberal Party in, like, 1972, 3, I believe. So when you
meaning,
look at...
Meaning what? For James is a philosophy major. So, whoa, hello. Sorry, Creighton's phone just went off. James is a philosophy major, so he's working towards becoming a professor. So he's a really smart individual. So
working toward becoming broke.
You know what my favorite thing to a philosophy major is? Give me large fries, please.
Isn't that a T-shirt?
Yes.
Don't you make fun of us liberal arts majors now?
Yes.
So, all right. So what is the new Liberal Party and the historical roots? Explain some of that real quick.
Okay. If you want to go back to, like, if it's like a 19th century philosophy, this is like a lot of French people that got together and just talked a lot of stuff like, hey, society kind of sucks.
Direct quote.
The roots of what a libertarian is born from an industrial revolution. This was a time when, like, if you were not uber wealthy, you had no rights. Mm-hmm. Essentially, you were sitting there, like, you know, 80 hours a week into a factory, you know, like 6-year-olds are dying in mills. So they had a philosophy as, like, different people. There's socialists involved in this. There were mutualists involved in this. There were hardcore anarcho-capitalist people involved in this. This was a movement that says there shouldn't be any force or state. So if I go back to, like, a roots of what libertarianism is in a European sense or philosophical sense, it's essentially a stateless society.
Mm-hmm.
So we have institutions for that. That's different from the Libertarian Party, like Center for a Stateless Society, the Mises Institute, I think Reason Magazine as well, like, posts a lot of articles for, like, left libertarian thinkers. We have, like, entire groups for these people. Like,
so does that mean that you're an anarcho-capitalist?
No. There are some people that follow that. There's usually a kind of argument within those camps. There's a lot of people that are anarcho-capitalists, but some people are purist anarchists, and capitalist is a hierarchical system because to make money, you buy stuff. It's hierarchical. So a lot of people say it's dialectical anarchism because it's just anarchy in name only, not anarchy in process.
Mm-hmm.
But if I were to say, like, you know, like how would this apply to, like, modern politics, you know, I can apply what a left libertarian is to different people. I can apply it to a Green Party member. I can apply it to a Socialist Party member. I can apply it to an Occupy movement. And the main basis of any of these movements or any of these parties is not necessarily, like, fundamentally what they agree in economics, because I think about 99.9% of people in this party would not agree with, say, John Strinka, the socialist candidate running in Carmel, about what to do with entitlements.
Which is funny that there is a socialist candidate in Carmel.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you describe yourself as a mutualist, right? Mutualism. What is that? Briefly,
it's a self-ownership philosophy. It's to say that if you look at like a biological term, like a mutual biology, it's like animals coexist, as in, you know, you have woodpeckers or whatever that lay on the back of rhinos to eat insects. So things have to work within a mutual benefit to get society. Like if you build roads, it doesn't have to be a government that builds roads, but it can't be someone doing it itself. Or you're going to throw the money down and pave, you know, like a 60-mile road by yourself. You need to kind of work together to get things done. So when you get into like the entire philosophy, like how do you apply it to everyday life, it's essentially saying like I need two other people to work with me, you know, so I self-own. So if I apply it to like a worker sense, like a Mondragon Institute in Spain, it's the worker unit, the labor unit that works in that company are self-owned. The people that own the capital sit there and they buy the building, they put the capital in there, but you let the workers self-manage. We don't really do that in the United States too much. There's a few co-ops that are in Indianapolis, a few co-ops elsewhere, like the Red and Black Cafe that do self-ownership. There's a few unions that do that, like the IWW. But for the most part, we still work on a wage system. Like we hire you to do this work. We don't say, here's the thing, make us product, sell us the product. So
hand the microphone over to my buddy Creighton. What do you think of mutualism? As what do you consider yourself, an Austrian economics?
Purely.
Anarcho-capitalist, what are you?
I would say ANCAP, purely.
Okay. So what is your critique of mutualism, what he just described, self-ownership?
That sounded a little bit like syndicalism. Is that close?
Whoa, English.
Syndicalism is like a next step. There's a branch of these philosophies, I think, what's left-leaning, what's right-leaning on this political spectrum. A syndicalist would be like someone like Chomsky. The difference between a mutualist and a syndicalist is syndicalists don't do intentional community. So if I was a syndicalist, I'd have to have some level of government that says this is how this is going to work. So we lay this down, lay this down. Mutualists can say there's choice. If you want to have your ANCAP community across the highway, whatever. You know, we're a direct democracy, so you can vote to move.
Is it socialism without government or what? I mean,
Not entirely.
Because how do you force somebody to – and I mean, are you saying you'd have to completely change the American mindset from, you know, I go to work for somebody to shifting what our notion of a corporation is necessarily?
Yeah. It's – the best way they described it was a professor wrote that it's called free market anti-capitalism. And what he meant by that was not saying like you can't make money. There's no concept of money or ownership. He was saying like when – how we live in a capitalist society, it's not capitalist at all. We're just led to believe it is. It's more like a corporate society. You know, we give entitlements to these corporations. The first thing to fix it, if you want to get to a root of how to be a mutualist, is you have to end all these laws for corporations. You know, getting rid of like limited liability, getting rid of the fact that, you know, I can lobby government for this specific thing. To break it down into like how I want to work as easily as possible into a society, you have to learn that you have to break government down to a very community-based thing where it's direct democracy. So this would be like saying if I want rules and regulations, like if I want to say my community thinks that I need to build a pool for the children to swim in, it's only the choice of my community. So I can get my neighborhood association of like 50 people together. We can have a vote, you know, majority passes, 42 out of the rest, you know, 50 say that we want to build this pool. So then you pay like into like a fund. You know, everybody just donates 50, 60 bucks every 2 weeks or something until you get enough to pay the pool, and then people have access to that pool.
Okay. So critiques, what do you
That sounds a little bit like a pure corporation though, where you had – because in order for that to logically make sense, you have to start with private ownership of goods. And therefore, they in order for it to be voluntary, they would have to voluntarily decide that we're going to form this organization where you want to build a pool. We want to build a pool, so we're going to put our assets into this stockpile, and people will take from it based upon these critiques. You have to vote for it. A majority gets this. This is what we're going to do with the money. It's organized by voting, which sounds a lot like what a pure corporation would do where they jointly own assets. And when they do that, they agree under contract that they're going to define how the assets are used in joint through voting. Or, I mean, they don't have to say voting, but that's usually what they do. They say you vote based upon – I mean, they can say you have one vote per person, but they also can say you have one vote per stock. But as far as – like, I'm not talking about the legal definition of a corporation. I'm just saying the idea of jointly owning assets as definition for a corporation.
Well, you don't really jointly own assets. Like when I have a stock, like I have stock in Kellogg's. I have what's called common stock, which means like if a company is like, we're going to change like our motto for what we say on Kellogg's for like the cereal, like I want my cereal to say it's twice the sugar. You know, I can vote on that when we have like, you know, a shareholders meeting.
As a person who deals with committees though for work, this sounds horrendous. Like you'd have to vote on cornflakes or like it sounds like you'd have to vote on every tiny little thing, and it sounds like democracy, which fundamentally does not work. It's very slow. I mean, a republic was set up to be a little bit faster than a democracy, but certainly not as quick as a dictatorship. And I know we're getting kind of heady, guys, but this is foundational stuff. This is the lens that James and left libertarians, the way that they sort of, that's their end goal for society. Now, James is not running on a platform of, you know, this is what I'm going to introduce as a state legislator. This is the lens that the philosophy that he looks through and then comes up with solutions and plans based on this philosophy. So, and you can check out some of his stuff online, let's go back to that notion of this being so painfully slow.
I mean, I guess people could say it's slow because it's like, well, we have to vote on everything. I think that's how people would view a situation where we vote like, what do you want for dinner? I don't know. We have to have like 3/5 majority to say if I want steak. You know,
right?
But the aspect is you're not voting on minute things. Like there's things that you can decide for yourself,
like toilet paper over or under.
Yeah, this is what you vote on are things that affect the entire community. So if Galt or Crichton or you want to sit there and say, I want to build a fence in my backyard, I'm not going to be like, well, we got to vote on that because I don't want that stupid fence in the backyard because I want free access to, you know, your grill when I'm bored at your house. No, you can do that on your own property. You still own.
So there is ownership of property in this ethic. Okay.
It's just, are we going to build a road? We need to repave the road. How are we going to
pay for it? So it's just an organization for things designated as public goods.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it almost sounds like an organized anarchism in a way, just a system of anarchism.
It sounds like a different form of governing because like for public goods now, for example, the roads, we do that through the American form of government with state and local and federal organization. Not necessarily claiming that it's the most efficient way to do it, but that's how it's primarily done. Money is taken from individuals and given to companies to pave roads or whatnot in order to provide something that everyone can use free of charge in the sense of you don't have to pay a toll to use it. It comes out of your tax dollars or in many cases it comes out of gas prices, gas taxes. But either way, it's an organization for what is considered a public good. So is what you're defining a different way of doing essentially the same thing that you think would be more effective?
Well, there's a statement that says taxes are theft, property is theft. Okay, so how you define that is if I wanted to tax somebody, it's wrong for me to tax you.
You got to talk right into the mic,
buddy. Yeah, I'm so used to like powerful mics. I'm sorry, man. I'm not good with your mics.
How dare you?
But taxes in the society, it's called a land value taxation, which is Georgism, which stated that the only thing that should be taxed is land because that's communal. That is something everybody shares into the land of itself. Because how did we get land in the first place? The only reason we ever had land was because we stole it from somebody else. We weren't born or inherited land or bought land. It's there
to an extent.
Us. And that's more of a primitive way of looking at it.
To an extent, that's true, though.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not necessarily true for every situation. I would say that you could claim that Native Americans had, under the Lockean private property ethic, had justification for the land that they lived on. And they tended to be, I mean, for a lot of them tended to be more communal, but nevertheless, you could claim that they were the first to be, because they came across and they were the first ones here. They came across on the Bering Strait and all that jazz. So you could say they had, and then it was unjust for people afterwards to just take the land from them. But I don't see that as any different than a normal anarcho-capitalist private property ethic in the same sense as like John Locke.
Well, how is it different than how an ANCAP would see property? Is how an ANCAP sees property, it's a sole ownership situation. land is not sole ownership. That's why it's land value taxed, which is saying, like, if you build a house, all right, like, you get a lot of land, like 3 or 4 or 5 acres, and you build a house because that's what you do with your money. The house is your private property. That is your possession. The land it's built on is communal because that land has been there before we were even an amoeba.
Yeah, but again, when we're talking about ethics, we're talking about man interacting with man. So, you know, ancient geology doesn't necessarily play into an ethic for how man should live with each other. So I don't necessarily see the difference between land, just because it's older, as any different than, say, a rock. Like, you can trade a rock, and it has, and it could be just as old as land. Again, you could have the same private property ethic of first of homesteading for any good, and it would work just the same for unowned, unused land. But I mean, yes, Europeans came over, and a lot of the land was owned under this ethic. They would be owned by Native Americans, and it was taken from them. And that's not necessarily true in every single case, but for the most part. Yes, Europeans came over and took land that could be logically and justifiably said to be owned by Native Americans and removed it forcefully from their possession. And that would be unjustifiable under at least an ANCAP private property ethic. But
they didn't use every square inch of North America is sort of what we're saying.
Well, that's not necessarily – that doesn't necessarily matter. A pure anarcho-capitalist private property ethic is very close, at least in the ways I have understood it, is very close to essentially the John Locke private property ethic. Where, I mean, the only thing I think it's different is John Locke would say that stuff was commonly owned, whereas a anarcho-capitalist would say it's unowned, it's non-owned, no one owns this, no one's been there
so
yet.
So until every human being settles on every square inch of North America, then
no, that so
it's not
yeah, it's essentially. So let's say that there were no Native Americans here, just for the sake of argument, and Europeans came over on their ships and they saw land, and let's say that they just said all the land I see is mine. That would not be justifiable under private property. They have to put their labor into it.
Building a fence.
So, yes, they have to fence it off. That's usually what would happen. You would fence it off. You can't claim ownership of something you didn't mix your labor with. But, yes, it would have to. You would have to have work done to a good that's unowned for it to become owned. After it's owned, and again, just remember, there is really nowhere in the world that this would work anymore because people have been everywhere already.
Right.
You would have, in order for it to be owned now, and it to be justifiable under a private property ethic as far as anarcho-capitalism sees it, you would have to have either, one, a gift, somebody who justifiably got – let's say you're on the second – let's say everything's owned, and then you're at the second step where now people want to maybe trade. So you would have – the only way that it would be justifiable ownership after trade would be the person who got it had to get it justifiably. They had to homestead it in the same way that was just described. So they could gift it to somebody, or they could trade it. They could say, I will give you this if you give me your justifiably owned good. But that's it. Other than that, you would have the only other way of getting property would be theft, which is force.
Right.
Because it's like, if it's not mutually voluntary, then it's force.
Well, let's
on one party or the other.
Let's talk about that. Let's bring it to modern day. Let's fast forward from all these people that probably 10 of our listeners have heard of, and let's talk about Ball State University. It came out this week that, or maybe it was last week, Ball State, actually, their board of trustees voted to build a brand new convention center, dorm room, and restaurants. And basically, it's going to be on-site training for their hospitality management program. And they're going to build this, I think it's like $26 million building on top of Hyatt Printing. Hyatt Printing is a 40-year-old shop that has stood on this ground that serves the university as the local print shop, and they are going to be forced to sell their business and their land to Ball State University by force of law so they can build this brand new hotel and conference center and restaurant and some dorms for the quote-unquote good of the public. Now, Ball State is the largest employer in Muncie, obviously, so they can pretty much do whatever they'd like. If you want some more information and links and some more information, go to lpin.org. We've got a story posted there. And if I remember, then I will link this to there as well. What about eminent domain? Okay, so we've talked about some of these private property rights. I mean, how do we look at eminent domain today? Eminent domain is in our Constitution, both federally and at the state level. We've seen it with I-65. I'll play devil's advocate and say to the three of you, James Neese joining us, he's a candidate for State House 100, Creighton Harrington, Chris Galt, I don't think I even introduced us, I'm Chris Spangle, welcome to the program, heard by tens of people across the nation.
tens of dozens
of people. So what is our view as libertarians of eminent domain in cases like I-65 and in the case of Ball State? Let's start with Creighton.
Well, I won't speak for all libertarians because, as we can see, there are people who can be libertarian and not agree on everything.
You're just mad, bro.
No. No, I like this. Anyway.
He still can't say any answer, though. He's just talking.
Eminent domain, I would say, is unjustifiable in every single case. The only way I could see something even close to that being okay would be if, like, some guy who owned, you know, say, a bunch of land and allowed people to live off his land and then up and said, I need this for a house, you have to leave.
What? So you're okay with that?
If a guy owns land and says, here, I will allow you to live on my land, that lease is only valid as long as he continuously agrees to allowing him to live on that land.
Right.
But the moment he decides, it's my land and I don't want you on it anymore, get off.
You don't think he should be able to do that?
No, he can do that.
Oh.
But it's different if you're talking about the government or the state,
right?
I would say, because there is no private property ownership.
Right.
Because if we're going to say eminent domain is valid, then we have to imply that all the land in the country is implicitly owned by the government. There is no private ownership of land.
Right, there isn't.
So I would be against eminent domain in that sense.
We had Bad and Eric. Bad and Eric told us.
Okay. I would be against eminent domain.
He just caves.
What did Bad and Eric say?
Bad and Eric said, you don't own your land. You only own the surface. You don't own anything under that topsoil. You don't own the land. You own the building on the land.
What about oil?
But you don't. Yeah, if there's oil in your backyard, you don't own the oil. The government owns the oil. The government owns the land. You don't own the land. You have a title to build.
We're not talking about specifically American constitutional. We're saying what would a libertarian who believes in an anarcho-capitalist private property ethic say against about eminent domain?
Bednarik was saying as it should be or as it currently is. Because, I mean, I watch Dallas every week, and because they found oil on South Fork Ranch, they're rich.
You watch Dallas?
Hell yeah.
Said it is how it is.
You have, JR. You,
I think Dynasty's on
next
week.
It is how
it
is.
Your mom. We're waiting.
Oh, you're waiting now.
Yeah.
Well, it's called an allocial title. It gives you the right to call land your own and build on it, and you own the labor that you put on top of the land, but the government owns the land.
Okay. As far as a anarcho-capitalist libertarian private property ethic would go, that would not be justifiable, and so far as the original owner of the land that is saying you own the buildings you can put on the land, but I own the land, if it's an individual private person who said that, who had justifiable ownership of that land prior, and then said you guys can live on it, then you do your thing. But when I say I don't want you on there, I have full right to do that because it's my land. That's fine. But when it's collective ownership,
no, you're right.
Through
and how
the federal
happened,
government,
but how this happened was then the U.S. government created the artificial person. the corporate person.
Okay, that's a little bit different than what we're trying to talk about. So that's I think you're straying off into a different topic.
I just think it's not what you want to accept or talk about.
No,
so.
I know
we're
what
gonna,
I know.
This is the Creighton Harrington show, so let's talk what Creighton Harrington wants to talk about.
He asked me a specific question, and you're going into the sovereign citizen stuff, and that's not what the question's about. And that's a whole other topic that we could do a whole show on.
Let's wrap this topic up, and excuse us, because we're having major technical difficulties as we record this, so even with our tongues, I apparently can't talk. So let's briefly go to James to talk about the eminent domain issue at Ball State. I mean, isn't it good that Ball State will create more jobs with this program? And, you know, Hyatt, they're great. Sure, they've been there for 40 years, and they do have employees, but they're going to get so many more employees from building this new building with Ball State.
Okay.
Even though it's funded by bonds.
If you want to look at it as an opportunity cost situation, like if it's like, well, is it going to make more money than this print shop? Because if it's a print shop isn't where it's, you know, like printing press technology where it's like screen printing, that is almost effectively dead. Like that will be dead in the next 20, 30 years. Everything is going to be digital. So this business is going to close down anyway. So according to Ball State,
You're so sunshiny.
Yeah. So according to Ball State, you know, I'll throw $26 million in here and you know, use it for a training thing for whatever our hotel management, whatever they're doing. Does it apply to, you know, am I making jobs at Ball State University? I mean, they add maybe like 5 or 6 people on the staff. You know, that's like, well, cool, you added 5 or 6 more on the staff. It's on the payroll already. So I don't think it's really going to help anybody. I think it gives Ball State its new area to play around in, its new toys. It doesn't help the printer. It doesn't help anybody in the job market, because how many people can the university afford? It's just going to go right into tuition. More people are not going to be able to afford it.
Right. So so that's sort of one of the fundamental problems that we have with our society, is that it seems like we're creating more jobs, but it's actually just a drain because it's public money. And speaking of public money, let's move into QE3 a little bit. This is quantitative easing 3.
What do you mean public money? New money.
It's new money. Chris or Creighton, would one of you like to explain what quantitative easing is and how it works? Let's go to Creighton Harrington.
Sorry, econ major.
He can probably explain it better than me because he's the econ major, so go for it, buddy.
Better than I?
Such an asshole.
I'm sorry.
I hate you guys.
I'm sorry. Anyway, if you would like to talk,
we're having major problems, not just with our technical, our cords and everything are melting down. The relationship between Chris Galt and everyone is slowly eroding. Come on, buddy. Cheer up, man. I'll buy you like a can of Pez afterwards.
He's like, man, I'm out of here. I'm gonna.
They make Pez in
like
cans.
A reform party bar. So,
if you would like,
no,
to,
you got it. No, seriously, you got it.
I don't want to. I don't want to.
I'm sure you
I
can
don't
define
impose.
It perfectly.
I don't want to impose.
Go for it.
It's just okay. It's new money. That's what it is. I mean, they print
all
new
right.
money.
Ben Bernanke announced today, right? Uh-huh. It was this afternoon that the Federal Reserve would be. Do you know the numbers?
$40 million.
$40 million?
$40 billion.
$40 billion, dude.
Sorry, I like to undercut him a little bit.
$40 billion new dollars?
A month.
A month?
Indefinitely.
Till the end of time.
Till he says that it's good.
All right. So.
You're just mad because you'll never see that money.
How is this going to affect the market? How is this going to raise prices? Would you call this inflation?
By definition, it has to raise prices eventually. Okay. If it doesn't raise them immediately, that's one thing, but it by definition has to.
Why?
Because that's all inflation is based upon, is the ratio of goods to money. So you increase money supply without increasing goods,
prices. So why do the Keynesians think that this is going to work?
Because
what is their logic behind putting more money into the system? Why do they? How do they defend that as being a...
Well, if it's on a fundamental level, they would argue that if there is involuntary unemployment, if we're not at full employment, then we could throw money out there and employ unemployed people that would therefore now be able to create goods that could absorb the inflation. And it would cause the economic engines to run. And then at the same time, they're lowering the interest rate. I mean, the interest rate's already pretty much as low as it can go.
So if it employed enough people, could it theoretically work?
No.
Okay.
Because the level, I mean, what it's going to do in the short run, I don't know. Like, it's hard to tell on this specifically. I think because he said he's going to do it indefinitely, the expectations for inflation are almost universally going to be understood. And when you expect inflation, it happens. So, you know, when you had QE 1 and 2, there wasn't any indication that he would do it again. After 1, you didn't think – there was no absolute indication he'll do 2. After 2, there's no absolute indication he'll do 3. Well, now he's saying, we're going to do it $40 billion a month until I say we're done. So the expectation for inflation is pretty much like a no-brainer.
Which is – aren't they're more worried about deflation, falling prices. So they
well,
think
Ben
that,
Bernanke is.
Right, because he thinks that that's, you know, that's what caused the Great Depression was – the deflationary spiral, and they don't want to create a deflationary spiral. But by constantly printing money, aren't they going to eventually cause that? Because once this money is released into the system, that's when it all falls apart, right? Why should we be worried about this? Because so far we haven't seen Armageddon. We're not in Old Testament times where we're rubbing ourselves in dirt and ripping our clothes and crying because, you know, I mean,
you gotta take pot shots, bro.
Well, sorry. I missed the fact that he's covered in dirt and looks like he's ripped his clothes.
I would say from a strictly, like, economic standpoint, you know, thinking as, you know, the fundamentals of economics, when you increase money, ceteris paribus, it's going to...
What?
All else equal. When you increase the supply of money... higher than, or if you just increase it all, really, if you increase money supply, it will have, especially if you do it through banking, which is how we do it now, it's going to have a reducing effect on the level of the interest rate. Long story short, you have a lower interest rate, it becomes more enticing to produce capital goods that otherwise would be too expensive. And the production of those goods come at the same time as consumption goods the demand for consumption goods are the same. The interest rate fundamentally is based upon preferences for goods now versus goods in the future. So the increased production of capital goods comes at the same time as the increased production of consumption goods. Resources fight with each other across time. So you have expansion. You have a big boom because everybody thinks everything's going well. And then eventually, because the resources weren't really there, the underlying valuations of consumers, the supply and demand wasn't really there to support the production projects as they have been taken, there has to be a crash. It's just the allocation. There's a misallocation of goods, which is what prices and the economy does. And there have to be reallocated, and eventually it has to happen. So now, and that's what happened in 2008 with houses. Right now, what they're trying,
Thanks for adding that, James.
What they're trying to do now is kind of offset the effect of what a recession is. A recession in the boom bust cycle is the correction of the misallocation that happened during the boom. So what they're trying to do is restrict that from happening because it hurts. So people don't want to be laid off. They don't want to be unemployed. People don't want to be losing money. But when it comes down to it, you were employed or you were building buildings that consumers just didn't demand is really what it ultimately comes down to.
Right.
And you can try and escape that fact by saying that we're going to throw money at these things so that they have this money anyway, but all you're doing is pushing the inevitable bust anyway. So what they it's funny because after the dot-com bubble burst in 2001, they said we should – Paul Krugman notoriously said that we should reinflate the dot-com bubble with a housing bubble, which is exactly what they did.
Right.
And that bubble burst. Mm-hmm. Well, now they're just saying we need to reinflate the housing bubble with, I mean, the people are trying to figure out what the bubble is now. It could be the government bubble. A lot of people have said the government bubble.
Education.
The education has been a big one, the education bubble. So it's really just what they're thinking, though, is that if they can keep the interest rate low, they can spur investment, which will increase production and create jobs. And that's technically true in the short run.
But it's not happening.
It's not happening. And
you have 26% of our nation is not working.
A lot of ignoring factors such as unemployment programs, which do have an incentivization for not working, mm-hmm. to an extent. It doesn't take over all incentives to work, but it does have some incentive to not work. So ignoring those and ignoring things like price control laws, like the minimum wage, which keep low-paying jobs from existing, which people don't really want anyway. But nevertheless, unemployment is up a little bit because of that, and it always will be while it exists. I don't really – the reason why the economy hasn't had that burst that would come from an increase in the money supply – it's just a lot of it. I mean, it has a lot to do with anticipation or
Pez.
No, I blanked on the word, and it's a normal word. They don't. Well, you don't know the future.
Give me what's the first letter.
No, it's just
unpredictable.
Unpredictable.
Foresight.
Foresight. Yeah, you know what I mean.
Intuition.
They don't know. They don't know what's going to happen. So people People don't know what's going to happen, so they're holding on to their money. You know what I mean?
Right.
Whatever that is.
You could. The problem is, like, when you say it's a Keynesian problem, right? It's like the Keynesians are doing something.
I keep
like
telling you guys it's the Canadians. Why doesn't anybody listen to me? It's the damn Canadians.
When you work with how this philosophy works, you can move to what's called a neo-chartalist way of dealing with it, is how you view debt. A neo-chartalist believes that debt is artificial. If debt's artificial, you can just mint a $15 trillion, $100 trillion platinum coin, slap it into the treasury, debt's gone. That's how they view. So if I wanted to say, like, well, what, you're asking, like, why we're inflating, why it's causing, like, a bad problem, is because while we're inflating it, we're not taxing it and spending. The whole point of inflation is to create a bigger tax base. And if government's not taxing and spending to get rid of that inflation, it's just going to keep rising. So unless, you know, I print, like, you know, $40 billion, $50 billion, $60 billion here, and I'm not doing anything with that money except just throwing it out there and being like, well, now eggs are $3, you know, for a dozen instead of $2. If I'm not taxing that and spending that on social programs, then I'm not doing anything with that money. It's just loose fringes. So if I wanted to say, like, I want to increase this, if I wanted to get an economy back on track by that inflation, I would need to make bigger and better social programs, which is what I think the Democratic establishment is trying to do with these different job bills, these farm bills. So we're going to make these tax and spend things. It's usually obstructed when it goes to, like, Congress, like, you know, Senate and the House. It's like, well, we're going to obstruct this bill. But the Federal Reserve will continue to inflate. But until one of the presidents or one of the congressmen actually lets through one of these social programs, these safety net programs go through to tax and spend, Obamacare is essentially going to take care of that with 23
well,
taxes.
It's not necessarily who's spending it that causes the price fluctuations that are not that don't reflect underlying values of consumers in the market and suppliers in the market. It's that it's getting spent. So just because the government was taking money that may have been just recently printed by the Fed from people in the economy and then spending it their own ways, It's adding to the fact that a misdirection of resources is occurring, because an increase in the supply of money reduces its value and causes various price indicators to reflect something that doesn't exist, because it's temporary. It's in the short run. So, and the major one has been the interest rate. I mean, that's the one that the Fed. I mean, the Fed is they're not giving it just to the government. They're giving tons of money to banks, which. Because, you know, increased supply of money, you know, supply goes up,
well,
price
money,
goes down,
the
interest
money
rate goes
to the
down.
Banks is
it's not going out.
It's not going to a treasury.
It's not going out really at all. They're just sitting on it. And that's what the big thing is, and that's what Bernanke is, you know, pulling his hair out over is that he's given all this money to these banks, and they're not loaning it. And that's what really is going to start kicking up price inflation is when they loan that money out.
And it's a great idea to give them even more money.
Yeah. No, people have been saying that the Fed needs to pass a policy to charge the bank a fee to have an excess reserve, it'd be ridiculous. Because if they did that, then they'd start loaning that money out and prices would just skyrocket. I mean, has anybody looked at the Fed's balance sheet of what they printed during the recession? Wasn't it like $16 trillion of new dollars that are now out there? They're just out there. A lot of them are sitting in banks. Some of them are sitting in foreign banks, and they're not being used because we're in a time of mass, you know, people don't want to spend money. Even though we're not technically in a recession, it's very recession-like. And if they ever start spending that money, we're going to see prices go up very quickly. Now, what you're alluding to is if they tax, then it removes that money from the system. And that would reduce price. That would offset inflation that would have occurred. So if they increased the money supply by 5% and then taxed 5%, it would kind of equal out in the end. But that's only if they don't spend it. So if they ended up taking that money and saying, we're going to use that to give to the unemployed, or we're going to build a bridge, or we're going to make another social program, all it's doing is it's moving from one person's pocket to another for them to spend. And it still has that effect of increasing.
It has to be moved to a treasury is what I'm saying. Like, if I get all this money, I'm taxing, you know, I got a 12% tax rate increase to get this money that's inflated into a thing. I have to put it into a treasury. I have to sit there and load our treasury back up. Our treasury is running on absolute nothing right now. It's all done by the Federal Reserve. It's all done by the banks. And as banks continue to collude, we don't have community banks anymore, investment banks anymore. We have about four or five major banks like Wells Fargo, Capital, that we need to – what we did with AT&T back in like was it like 70s, 80s, and 90s with the antitrust bill that we nailed AT&T with.
Such is.
We need to sit there with every large bank that has this money that they're not touching is to reenact laws to make antitrust on banking and break these large banks into smaller subsidiaries.
I would say the easiest way to do that would just be to reduce to remove the laws that helped them out in the first place. One of the reasons you have these monopoly banks or monopoly anything that tends to pop up in an economy like ours is because they have legislation to protect them from competition. Because in a hardcore fundamental economic level, you can't have a monopoly. You can have, you know, sole ownership of, you know, one people produce one good and they're the only ones that own it, which technically is a monopoly. I mean, I would say Apple has a monopoly over iPods, but as far as like integration of the production from raw material to consumption good, it can't happen. It's economically impossible because in order to have a price, you have to have a trade. And if you don't have a trade, you can't have a price. You don't know how to allocate your goods and on, you don't know how to allocate your goods. You don't know whether or not you're doing things cost effectively, and eventually you're going to have inefficiency and you're going to go under. So you can't have a huge monopoly, but you can if you have legislation that protects you from the competition that would have emerged to go against your inefficiencies. So I would say the best way to make big banks not be so big is to stop making laws that protect them from the market. And that goes for any kind of business.
But we've deregulated over 100 laws for the banking industry in the last 10, 20 years. It's not an issue we're making
when?
Better laws.
What laws?
I mean, we've got rid of the Glass-Steagall.
Glass-Steagall didn't do really anything, though. All it did was say is that all Glass-Steagall said was they didn't repeal all of it. They repealed one part of it that said the same holding company can't own a commercial bank and investment bank at the same time. A holding company. It didn't say the same bank couldn't do commercial banking and investment banking. I don't necessarily know if that ever happens there or whatnot. But as far as a holding company can't hold a commercial bank and an investment bank before Glass-Steagall, this part was repealed. Now that part was repealed, and that was but that happened in the 90s during the beginnings of a bubble that was emerging in housing. So you had the foundations for this burst in housing occur, you know, that was already occurring in the 90s. Deregulation in a massive sense. I mean, there was some laws that some major federal laws that were repealed, but to say that those were the, you know, smoke and, you know, the smoking gun as to what caused this massive increase, and at least if we're going to talk about the current recession, what caused this massive increase in mortgages, there isn't really that smoking gun. And there weren't a ton of deregulated laws as far as federal laws go. I mean, Glass-Steagall is the most prominently known, but again, it was only that one part. The rest of the law still existed.
But the issue with Glass-Steagall is when the law was repealed, I think it was like Section E, which dealt with, you know, security deposits within a community-owned bank or an investment firm, which was how can this money collude. When that money was able to intermingle through those holding things you were speaking of, is that's when you saw a trend with all these banks, hundreds of different banks, that kind of pulled off through J.P. Morgan, that pulled off through Chase, that started pulling off into these large things because these large banks were able to go back and say these holding firms can now buy up these small individual banks and we can charter them out to a larger bank because now a larger bank can handle these security deposits as opposed to a large Federal Reserve. So we have small banks like your Regions Bank, your small, you know, community banks are now being pulled into a larger bank, which is causing a monopoly. So what's going to have to do is, you know, after a few more years, when some of these banks, large banks, start to collide as well, like Wells Fargo comes into J.P. Morgan, is you're going to have to antitrust them. You're going to have to break them up and put all these regulations back in place that were repealed over the last 30, 40 years, or you're going to have a system that's going to sit there and suck up all this money that's not going to be spent, that's not going to go back into a treasury, that is just going to be rotting the entire out, and you're going to have a situation with bank runs. There was a bank run at one of the banks in New York, and when people started withdrawing all that money, the bank freaked out and people were arrested. And are we going to go back to a time with Andrew Jackson when it was a free banking area where everybody was bank running and there was not enough money to cover anything for farming expenses for farmers, which causes a worse depression than what we see now?
Well, you can't have a bank run if you have 100% reserve ratio.
But we don't.
I know we don't. And that, I think, I come from a people that I believe we need to have 100% reserve ratio. So whether we can do that through free banking or we have to pass a law, which that's something I haven't completely figured out yet.
Well, we're going to have to come back to the real world now, and we're going to have to end this podcast. So.
Oh, man.
Thanks for joining us, Galt.
Thank you.
No,
got that and cap to say pass the law.
No, I mean, again, the free banking people have made consistent arguments to say that you could have a 100% reserve ratio emerge through market forces. But either way, I would say that if you don't have 100% reserve ratio, you can't have a bank run. I would say that, again, that concept of collusion and bigger people eating up the little ones has always occurred in any industry ever. And a lot, I mean, a good one is with the Standard Oil. I mean, new businesses people were actually taking out investing capital into new oil businesses so Standard Oil would buy them. And I mean, he literally created incentives for people to compete with him. And then, I mean, Standard Oil ended up losing its market share long before the antitrust stuff. So yeah. Again, it comes down to the fact that the incentives the fundamental incentives do not exist to allow a monopoly to get so large that it controls everything. Because again, if there's no trade, there's no price. If there's no price, there's no efficient allocation. And a monopoly just cannot overcome that fact. It can't do it. It's literally economically impossible.
Well, I liked the lively debate.
At James's pants. James looks like the Scarecrow pants. It's like the Scarecrow.
It was a great episode with your hosts, Chris Spangle, Creighton Harrington, and James Neese.
We're not done
Special
yet.
Special guest Chris Galt.
Where do you have to go?
We are.
You got to rush home and get on Reddit.
We're way done,
but we need to wrap up properly. So let me ask you, boys, as college students who are getting back to it, what is coming up on college campuses with the libertarian focus groups on the college campuses?
I'm just gonna pass around like 2 minutes or something.
Do you got anything going on?
Yeah, Gary Johnson, but we talked about it at the beginning.
All right.
We got a Creighton's Econ debate is going on, which you could ask them what their opinion is on quantitative easing and eminent domain or whatever we were talking about today.
You weren't really paying
attention. There is a 30-minute question and answer session.
So you can come and ask them. You'll get three different perspectives on the answer from libertarian conservative and a socialist?
One libertarian, three different answers.
It's Brake, Robert Murphy of the Ludwig von Mises Institute, Richard Brake of ISI, and Mark Bilodeau, who teaches economics at IUPUI, and they're all going to debate morality of capitalism. October 3rd from 6:30 to 8:15. Doors open at 6.
All right.
In the campus center, room 450C. So if you want to go and just record this, if you hear this episode, save it and come to this part of the podcast, and that's all the information you need.
And next Tuesday at 2 o'clock, Azhar Majid from the FIRE, which is free. Foundation for Individual Rights and Education. He's a speaker from there, and he's going to be coming to IUPUI Tuesday at 2, which anybody can come to. It'll be outside. We'll have pizza, and you can come and hear about constitutional rights on campuses.
And so, you guys kind of need it there.
We do. We're a yellow light campus. We have restrictive speech codes. He's going to talk to us about that, how we can change it.
And then if you are at any libertarian campus, James, you got anything going on at U of I or other college campus stuff or candidate stuff?
We do our little LLA group, which is just me and a bunch of kids that it's, I think like he was talking about today, his group's like, we got to get a book club going on. It's a book club. Mm-hmm. Like, hands down, we meet in the library.
You read?
Oh, yeah, we read.
Oh, my
God. The internet.
So, the internet.
But,
yeah.
The internet. Working to get bylaws passed to work with, you know, like how college Republicans work or how young college Democrats work to work with, you know, third parties on campus as well to get in like a same boat as these two major organizations that have, you know, national parties that work with them as well. So we're trying to get that worked out, but pretty much right now we're just trying to see if we can get at least like, you know, more than 10 members and kind of just discuss things, like talk about what's going on. And essentially it's me and
it's like a podcast without the tens of listeners.
Yeah.
Mic problems.
Yeah. It smells like Panucci oil. But that's about it for me.
All right. And then if you want to check out any on the libertarian side, our candidates need as much help as you can provide. So go to lpin.org/candidates. And then check out all of our candidates, you know, top of ticket anywhere in Indiana, you know, even nationwide. If you're one of our Rivertown Radio listeners down in South Carolina, Gary Johnson, Judge Gray. If you're here in Indianapolis, check out our buddy James Neese. Thanks for stopping by, James, and thanks for being on the podcast. And Galt got an email during the song. And thank you for, you know, not committing any murders.
Like us on Facebook.
Like us on Facebook.
Like us on iTunes.
And please, be
or
a
if
dear.
That, if you can do that, or vote us up, or give a good review,
go
or
to
five
Stitcher.
Star.
Go to Stitcher. We were featured on What's Hot on Stitcher this week, believe it or not, because enough people gave us a thumbs up on Stitcher. I don't know, probably like two.
It
was enough thumbs up to get us on the What's Hot. So I don't know. Go to Stitcher, give us a thumb and a liking, and then go to iTunes and rate us.
Five stars.
Five stars. This is a five-star podcast. Last week, 5 stars. This week, 2.5.
Just do it. Just do us a favor. Yeah,
only because I didn't help out as much.
Yeah, Galt was kind of quiet.
Take it over, and it went down.
We had a lot of chord problems and a lot of Discord problems on this episode. So, obviously, we will do better next time. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next weekish.
I'll just breeze the whole way through and then
get
pissed.
We're not done. Stop being a little baby. I'll punch you in the head.
Crane won't even play fantasy football with me now.
Yeah, when this mic gets on, I'm going to start talking about sovereign wealth funds, and it's just going to get very, very Scandinavian here in like 2 minutes or 5 or 20.
But that's irrelevant, James. We don't want to talk about that.
We don't want to talk about sovereign wealth funds.
Are you going to sit there and tell me that you weren't going to go into a long spiel about the history of the 14th Amendment?
Were you going to go into a long
the only
discussion
group of people
the
in the world?
Were you going to go into a long
like
talk
that.
About the 14th Amendment and how it created a little C citizen versus a big C
But you
citizen.
Know about it.
I know about it, but you're
Check 1 2 check that like is better. To check 1 2.
Right, then we can do a whole podcast over.
Do you want to do a
okay.
whole podcast
talking about private property?
You didn't have to be rude about it. All you had to do was say
that you wanted to do a whole entire episode over the issue, and we could have moved on.
We can do a whole episode over it.
You just blah, 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 blah.
Listen to the recording. Listen to the recording. I said we can do a whole podcast over it, and then you went, oh, I'm Chris, and I'm upset because I didn't get to say what I wanted to.
I'm sad because I'm flying.
This podcast is produced by What is a Hoosier Productions.